Sometimes one economic indicator becomes more important than the other economic indicators. Today's entry is brought to you by the letters C, P, and I. From American Public Media, this is Market Flash. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 13th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the economic news that is going to be top of mind tomorrow. A little thing called CPI, the Consumer Price Index, best known really by its street name, inflation. 8:30 tomorrow morning, Washington time, that is, and this is important, before the opening bell on Wall Street. The good people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics are going to let us know how much consumer prices went up last month. You think back to last week and the market agita we got after news that wages had gone up, thus raising fears of inflation, and you can see why people are going to be paying attention. The thing is, we can measure inflation pretty well, but predicting the darn thing, not so easy. Marketplace's Sabri Menashor gets us going.
You think the weather people have it hard? Try predicting inflation.
It's one of those puzzles that PhD economists at the Federal Reserve have been working on for years and really not getting a whole lot closer to figuring out what makes it tick.
Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial.
The primary fear is if we don't know where inflation comes from, if we're watching the wrong place, it could sneak up on us.
He says part of the problem is that for a long time, people assumed that there was a simple relationship between unemployment and inflation. If more people have jobs and more people get raises and more people spend their money, wages and prices should go up in the economy.
The problem is, for decades now, we just haven't seen that happen.
In fact, just last year, especially, we didn't see that happen. Unemployment fell and still barely any inflation, and people don't know why.
2017 was a bit of a mystery.
Alan Detmeister used to study inflation at the Fed. Now he's an economist at UBS, and he agrees that the drivers of inflation month to month are murky, but
we have a pretty good idea, kind of in the longer run, what's driving inflation.
You can boil it down, he says.
The main mechanism is the relationship between supply and demand.
Put most simply, people buy more stuff and prices go up. And there's a lot of other stuff, too, that affects prices.
When the dollar falls, this drives up the cost of imported goods. Other supply factors are things like oil prices.
But knowing all these long-term factors doesn't help predict inflation in the short term, which is still hard. The Fed says we're going to inch towards 2% inflation this year. Inflation reports like tomorrow's will start to tell us just how right or wrong the Fed is. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
As Sabri was saying, also interested in where inflation is in this economy is the Federal Reserve. Best guesses are the Fed is going to raise, as Sabri alluded to, its short-term interest rate three times this year, maybe four if inflation really gets going. And as we all know, what the Fed does rolls downhill monetary policy-wise into consumer interest rates and the broader bond market, government treasury bonds in particular. Traders there always like to know what the Fed's thinking as well. Today, though, a top bond trader at Goldman Sachs says he figures the yield, that is the interest rate paid on the 10-year Treasury note, is going to go as high as 3.5% by the summertime. It is, just for some context here, 2.83% today. It's been a while since we've been in a world of rising bond yields. So what happens economically when that happens? From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
When bond market folks talk about the yield, that's the payoff you and I get for lending money. If I put 100 bucks into a 10-year treasury, I get it back in 2028 plus a yield of 2.8%. That's not bad if inflation is low, but it could be heating up. So bond sellers have to boost the yield to lure me, the investor. Sheila Chinkel is former research director at the Atlanta Fed.
If something pays you 2% and inflation is 2%, you're not earning anything. So nominal bond yields move with inflation.
Goldman Sachs believes the Federal Reserve matters too. If the Fed raises short-term interest rates four times in the next few months, as the Goldman bankers think, that could push up long-term rates and yields too. Much of this reflects an economy that's humming along, says economist Mickey Levy at Berenberg Capital Management.
The change in 2018 that leads people to expect higher bond yields are continued momentum in the U.S. economy. On top of that momentum, you're going to get some extra stimulus from tax reform and likely defense and infrastructure spending.
Now for the trade-off. Higher interest rates mean higher borrowing costs, says Richard Warr at NC State's Poole College of Management.
Pretty much all consumer credit, like car loans, other kinds of loans, and including mortgages as well, will become more expensive. The interest rates will increase on those. It will probably reduce demand for some of those things.
But how much is hard to know. Just so you know, Goldman Sachs is forecasting higher yields and higher interest rates than most on Wall Street. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street started low today, equities-wise, ended high. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yes, he is worth a whole lot of billions of dollars, but it's been a rough couple of years for Mark Zuckerberg and the company he owns. Facebook is at the uncomfortable center of the controversy over the 2016 election for how easily the company's news algorithms were duped by the Russians. Nicholas Thompson is the editor-in-chief of Wired. He shares the byline on the magazine's March cover story about this topic. It's titled Facebook's 2 Years of Hell. Nick, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
This is an article about how Facebook handles the content on its site in many different ways. I need you to back me up, though, and tell me what was going on, say, in 2016, which seems like a long time ago, but wasn't, and what the philosophy of the company was then.
Well, in 2016, which is really where the story starts, Facebook believes fundamentally that it's a platform, not a publisher. It's a place where people put information, but it really doesn't have a responsibility for what that information is. And then something really crucial happens in the spring of 2016, which is there's a big controversy over whether Facebook is algorithmically biased against Republicans. It involves this thing called trending topics, and it's complicated. But what happens is that the controversy hits, everything goes viral. And then afterwards, Facebook is like, whoa, we can't be seen as having a bias against Republicans. You know, we don't think the stories are true. We don't think the criticism is true, but we have to do everything we possibly can to make sure that perception doesn't get out there. And so from that moment on through the election, they kind of turn a blind eye to fake news, possibly even to some of the Russia stuff, because so much of that is favoring Trump and they really don't want to be accused of bias. So that's where the story begins.
Flash forward then to, say, earlier this year after the election at some point, was there, I'm going to paraphrase you in this article, was there a holy cow moment when they realized what was going on?
Yeah, there were two. I mean, the first is when Trump wins and then Zuckerberg says, oh, wait, his first instinct is, oh, we had nothing to do with that. Fake news had no effect on the election. His second reaction is, oh, wait, maybe we did play a big role in that. You can't say that they threw the election to Trump one way or the other, but Zuckerberg realized they did have an important impact. The second holy cow movement comes in, say, May or June of 2017, when they realize it wasn't just fake news. It wasn't just false information put by teenagers in Eastern Europe on it. There was actually a manipulation campaign by Russian propaganda experts that Facebook completely missed and that they only found about 6 months after the election. And that was a moment where, as one of the executives said, and again to paraphrase, holy cow, this is a national security situation.
Among the many amazing tidbits in this piece is a thing you mentioned where one of the things maybe Facebook wanted to have been looking for was whether the ad payments were made in rubles.
Yeah, I love this detail. So Facebook learns, quite possibly just from a throwaway line in a Time magazine story, also from things they possibly heard on the Hill, that Russian propaganda experts appeared to be buying ads. So they start to dig in and they're like, well, let's look at all the ads purchased and let's look for signatures. Let's look for browsers that had the language set to Russian. Let's look for purchases set in rubles. And they find these ads. But then somebody miscalculates something about the transaction, maybe the exchange rate between rubles and dollars. And so suddenly at Facebook, it looks like millions of dollars were spent on ads when really it's thousands.
So let's cut to the chase then and get us to this year after the election. This has all been going on. Zuckerberg's initial reaction to allegations that maybe Facebook had played a role was that it was, in your words, peevish dismissal. But somebody else in this piece describes him as Lenny in Of Mice and Men. He does not understand his power. Do you think Zuckerberg now finally gets it?
I do think that. You know, the image on the cover is of a bruised Mark Zuckerberg, but smiling and looking looking like somebody who's confident about what's going to happen. I do think that there's been a real shift in the way he sees Facebook and the way he sees its responsibilities. And I think you can see that in the changes he's announced, in his resolution this year that he's going to fix it, in the earnings call where he said this is so important, he's willing to sacrifice some money. Yeah. So I think they will head in a different direction.
Nick Thompson is the editor-in-chief at Wired. The piece that he wrote with Fred Vogelstein is, well, it's a long one, but it's a good one. It's called Facebook's 2 Years of Hell. That'd be 2016 to today. It's online now. It's on newsstands, I guess, in a week. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me here.
There's a full-blown philanthropic scandal going on over in the UK. Britain's main charity regulator has launched an inquiry into the aid group Oxfam amid allegations the agency covered up a sex scandal involving some of its senior staff. There is money on the line to be lost, of course, but also the not small matter for any charitable organization of misplaced public trust. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
In the aftermath of the earthquake in 2010, hundreds of aid workers descended on Haiti. Among them, some Oxfam staffers. It later emerged that a handful of them had engaged in sexual misconduct. The details were shocking. They had partied and paid local women for sex in that devastated and traumatized country. Some, it's feared, may have used underage prostitutes. An instance of exploitation and betrayal, says former British government minister Andrew Mitchell.
This is a shudderingly awful tale. Terrible on every single level. It eclipses the fact that Oxfam is one of the most brilliant humanitarian organisations in the world.
But many felt the organisation fell short when, in 2011, it discovered what had been going on. Four of the workers were quietly fired, another three were allowed to resign, two of them went on to work for other aid agencies. Details of the misconduct were not fully reported. Oxfam's chief executive, Mark Goldring, who wasn't in office at the time, says the group was at a loss to know what to do.
At that time, the use of prostitutes was not explicitly contrary to Oxfam's code of conduct. So there was an exploration of, well, how should the organisation respond?
The response, it now admits, was woefully inadequate. Some critics say Oxfam was motivated mostly by concern about the impact of these revelations on funding. Dame Hilary Bloom of the Charities Advisory Trust.
If you see your charity as an operation to raise money and you think that what you're doing is about money, then you want to keep very quiet about it.
If money was the motivation in playing down the scandal, it's horribly backfired. The British government pays Oxfam a grant of $43 million a year. Minister Penny Mordaunt has an ominous message for the aid agency.
If the moral leadership at the top of the organisation isn't there, then we cannot have you as a partner.
And the European Union has also warned that it could pull its $40 million grant from the group. Most worrying for Oxfam, though, is what happens to public opinion. The agency draws the bulk of its $400 million annual British revenues from public donations. Member of Parliament and former aid worker Peter Kyle.
This scandal could bring Oxfam to its knees, and the people who will suffer the most will be the thousands of people who depend on the work that Oxfam does.
Barring any further damaging revelations, Oxfam does seem likely to survive, but its revenues will be dented, and the episode may further erode public support for the whole UK aid budget, at $19 billion a year, one of the biggest in the world. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There is no such thing as a free museum. Someone pays for it.
That's somebody? It's going to be you. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up a 0.1% today, about 39 points on the blue chips, 24,640. The NASDAQ gained 0.4%, 31 points, 7,013 there. The S&P 500 up 0.2%, about 6 points, 2662. Amazon in the medical supplies business? Sure, why not? The e-commerce behemoth says it's looking to expand its Amazon business marketplace to cater to the healthcare industry. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. The news did send a chill through some healthcare carrier, supplier, and service companies. Shares of McKesson down 1.9% today. Cardinal Health dipped 0.3%. Apple CEO Tim Cook got a thumbs up from shareholders today for his management proposals at its annual meeting. Shares notched up 1% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note, as I said a little while ago, 2.83%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The labor market in this country, as we've been reporting for a while now, is tight, especially in the upper Midwest. In Wisconsin, in particular, the jobless rate is 3% on the nose, according to the most recent data, more than 1% below the national average. Companies there just need more people. So they are going to get them. The state is making a multi-million dollar marketing play to convince millennials and younger workers in Chicago that Wisconsin is the place for them. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
Here's the tagline of the campaign. Wisconsin, it's more you. That phrase is plastered on Chicago's trains, bars, gyms, and even on YouTube. In one video, young Chicago residents look bored out of their minds as they take the train to work.
An hour commute or an hour with friends? In Wisconsin, the average commute is less than 22 minutes.
Playing up Wisconsin's shorter commute time, boasting its low cost of living, are ways to court young people in Chicago, says Kelly Leitz. He's with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which launched the campaign.
We need to increase the in-migration to our state to take advantage of the jobs that are being produced by our very healthy economy.
And the state's unemployment rate is at a low 3%. Given the country's tight labor market, more states could start poaching workers across borders. That's something cities already do, says Andy Levine of the marketing firm Development Counselors International.
You know, cities, a number of them are doing roadshows. They'll bring, 12 to 15 of their largest employers, and they will basically try to attract people to sort of a job fair.
Ken Johnson is a demographer at the University of New Hampshire. He says if states like Wisconsin are trying to woo 20-somethings, good luck. But
if the target were to be people in their 30s and 40s, that would be a group that at least our migration data would suggest is much more likely to be attracted to more suburban locations.
To go beyond millennials, Wisconsin's governor wants to spend nearly $7 million to convince people that the state offers more than cheese, beer, and Packers. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
We've got a project we're doing this year across all the Marketplace programs about the 10 years since the financial crisis hit and how that decade has changed us. It's called Divided Decade, and we're looking at the whole smash, from small-scale stuff like individual spending habits to how our big economic institutions have changed to how we all think and feel about our futures. Today's installment comes from Diana Velasco. She's a case manager at a senior center here in Los Angeles.
I think that because we were growing up during that recession time, it's hard for me to remember what was the life before that and after, because we just grew up with it. So it's a little bit different for our generation. Because I work with seniors, I'm a little jealous when I hear the stories. I'm like, it was so much easier back then to get a home, and things weren't as expensive. The rent weren't as high, so people could save up to buy a home. Now all your money goes to rent if you're renting, so it's a dream. To get a home, it's like, when? But maybe someday. You still hope for it. I think rents are so high that it's so hard for us to live on our own. I had to live with my parents right after college because it's just so expensive. I wish I could invest, but I'm living day by day, honestly, because with the rents and my car bill and just all the bills, I haven't been able to, but it's something that it's on my mind and I want to do as soon as possible, because honestly, we don't know about Social Security. We don't know what's going to be there for us, our generation. So we have to prepare.
We've got a picture of Dinah Velasco on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM. Take a second while you're there. Tell us how the financial crisis changed you. Would you? We're using the hashtag #HowWeChanged. The Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York is one of the world's great museums, and that greatness does not come cheap. For almost 50 years, though, the Met has let people pay what they wanted to get in the door, as much or as little as they saw fit, although the museum did suggest $25 would be good. Starting next month, though, only residents of New York State and students from New Jersey and Connecticut are going to be able to pick their price. Most other visitors will have to pay the full $25. And as Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth reports, that might change some things.
Regular visitors to the Met tend to have a number, a dollar amount they like to pay. Take Dan Weiss. In grad school, he'd pay a dollar to get in. Later on, he chose to pay $5 and eventually the full suggested fee. Although, now?
I don't have to pay. I pay with my life.
Weiss is the museum's president and CEO.
There is no such thing as a free museum. Someone pays for it. So the question is not, should it be free? The question is, who should pay?
Ask a New Yorker that, and they're likely to say, not me.
I will probably give them a quarter, because I know they got way more money than me.
29-year-old Janelle Stein is headed inside.
All right. I used to pay a dollar. Now I'm doing a little better in life, so I pay 10.
Yeah, well, if you got it, you know. I don't have it yet. I'm still at an economic disadvantage, so...
This ability to pay a quarter to see one of the greatest art collections in the world, this is something people cherish about this museum. And it's why they're so angry about the new policy.
Everybody should have access to art. You know, everybody should be able to enjoy it and see it. And I don't think it's fair to deprive people.
Folks are worried that mandatory admission will change who comes to the museum, making it less accessible to low-income and diverse audiences. The thing is...
From a data standpoint... It won't.
Colleen Dillenschneider is with Impacts Research and Development, and she says the data are clear on this. Ticket prices don't affect attendance. People who visit the Met are just as likely to attend a museum with mandatory fees.
A decision not to visit a museum is more often a function of lifestyle than finances.
In other words, the kind of people who go to museums are the kind of people who go to museums, regardless of price.
Museums need to do a better job letting people know that museums can be engaging and fun to more than highly educated white people of a certain household income.
Dylan Schneider says making audiences more diverse sounds warm and fuzzy. But for museums today, it's actually an existential need.
Okay, I don't know how to do this without jargoning you. What's happening to museums right now is a thing called the negative substitution of the historic visitor.
This is actually pretty simple. Those highly educated white people of certain household income, they are the historic visitor, and their demographic is shrinking.
So that means if museums want to survive, they need to do a better job attracting diverse audiences and making them into regular supporters who will pay admission.
Our goal is to get people into the museum early in their lifetimes and then ideally repeatedly.
Met CEO Dan Weiss.
Once they come in the building and they experience what we have to offer, they see the value, the admission question melts away.
Weiss says the admissions change is just one of a half dozen dials the museum is twisting to improve its long-term economic outlook. Part of that is cultivating new visitors. In the past decade, the Met's seen its non-white American audience grow from 21% to 27%. Though Weiss says that's not where he wants it to be.
The ultimate goal is that the people inside the building reflect the people outside the building.
Outside the building, Janelle Stein's friends are getting impatient.
My classmates are
right here. Can I have 30 more seconds with her? So, have you been here before?
It's been a long time.
Stein grew up 3 miles away, but she hasn't been to the Met since a fifth grade field trip. 20 years later, she's here again for school. She says coming never occurs to her. Most of her friends and family barely know this place exists. That's not a problem for Stein, but it might be one for the Met. Pretty soon, the museum will need her more than she needs it. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloth for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. Yes, I'm a day early, but I saw it in the Wall Street Journal this morning, so here you go. Maybe I'm just doing Valentine's Day wrong, but according to the market research firm NPD Group, restaurant orders of chicken wings are 14% higher on Valentine's Day than the rest of February, Super Bowl Sunday aside, of course. Says Charlie Morrison, the CEO of the chicken wing restaurant chain Wingstop, quote, sharing chicken wings, you're ready to be vulnerable with somebody because there's going to be food on your face. End of quote and romance, actually. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 0.1% today, 39 points. NASDAQ gained 0.4%, 31 points. S&P 500 rose 0.2%, 6 points. Just to get back to where we were at the beginning, 8:30 tomorrow morning, Washington time, Consumer Price Index. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.